From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And we do that by building the Backyard Advantage, which really is the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And that community, it has been manifested in a way, or it's been built in a way through this show where we've told stories of winning, and I've made friends, and the friends have become a community, and it's a lot of fun. And my new friend is coming on the show today. I think you're going to really like today's guest. He is Brian Raymond. He is the founder of CEO of Unstructured. They're a high-tech company in artificial intelligence. We'll talk about his company because it's doing really, really well. It's blowing up. But maybe I'll just set it up with welcoming you to the show, and then I'll share with you like my first impression. So welcome to the show. How's it going?
Mark, thanks for having me, man. I'm excited to be here and for the conversation today.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to set it up for the audience of how well I know you. I don't know you that well. Okay. So this is one of those kind of like, sometimes you get fixed up on a date. Other times you're like, oh, I don't, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to ask this person out? So I see your picture in the business journal, and your company is Unstructured and it's doing well. You've got this big article about you, and I'm like, I'm kind of shy, but I'll reach out through, I think, LinkedIn. Hey, you know, hey, what's up? You got a couple minutes of your time? So we end up going to lunch, right? Somehow you said yes. And then I realized, okay, we have a lot in common, even though we're two different generations, basically. You're younger, but we both married Delaware girls. We're both from Roseville. Did you go to Oakmont High School?
Yep, both Vikings.
Both Vikings. You went to our video stores back when we had video stores, and now we live practically right down the street from each
We're
other.
Neighbors.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, I love this guy. I got a new best friend. So welcome to the show. You want to start? Why don't we just talk about Unstructured overall, what it is, and then maybe your journey to into entrepreneurship and Unstructured.
That sounds great. Well, thanks again for having me on, Mark, and love what you built here with Growth Factory and your show. It's really incredible. With Unstructured, we're a three-year-old startup. We're about 70 people on the team. What we focus on is really the picks and shovels of AI. And so most folks, or some of you might have heard of like ChatGPT, generative AI, these like incredible models that you can use now to automate business processes, accelerate a lot of work that folks are doing. But these models have three problems out of the box. One, they're frozen in time. Two, they tend to make stuff up. We call that hallucination. Mm-hmm. They hallucinate. And then three, they don't know anything about your organization, right? And so the trick is, how do you take all of the unstructured data? We think of unstructured data as natural language, like written, audio, and video or image. And how do you make all of that available to these models as quickly as possible so that it can actually be like a smart assistant, right? And so for us, excuse me, what we do is we've developed technology to take, like, almost like a giant wood chipper. You can take any of these files, like about 60 different file formats, any different layouts, any different peculiarities. We normalize all of it into a format that these large language models, these Gen AI models, absolutely love. And we do it at enormous scale. And so we work with large, like really large companies. We work with small developers and Gen AI native startups, but all, you know, anyone that's wanting to bring organization or private data or, you know, specific data to these models typically are using us under the hood.
Okay, so you sit in between the ChatGPT or whatever the large language model is and the data that the client has, and you make sense out of their data. I have to imagine, like, there's big concerns from these companies that have all the data, right? They have all this data. They see it as sort of useless at some level now, or harder to use because it's not structured.
Yep.
And so basically, do they just dump that data into your platform and start asking it questions?
Yeah, I think the way that this typically goes with these larger organizations that are making these investments, like, we kind of think about the world as starting November of 2022. That's when ChatGPT was released.
Okay.
Just to give everyone kind of a high level history here, here's what happened. ChatGPT was released, and you could ask it questions, make it make dad jokes, spaghetti recipes, whatever. And they're like, oh, this is interesting. And by the holidays that year, folks were getting bored with it. And they're like, all right, but I want to be able to, you know, ask questions of like, what is my sales team doing? Or what, you know, where are we going out to dinner Friday night? Or, you know, ask all these other things. And they're like, okay, well, they dusted off this kind of esoteric research paper that was written by researchers at Facebook back, I think, 2018, 2019, called Retrieval Augmented Generation. Everyone, don't fall asleep on me here. But it was really interesting. It was like, okay, let's take this model and let's hook this sucker up to like an external database. And now that's live. Now it knows what's knows about your organization. You can force it to show its homework or to ground its answers on that data, right? And you're countering these three key problems. And so what you do is you take your data out of Google Drive, SharePoint, wherever it might be. You normalize it. You store it in, let's call this a library. And now the intern, which is the model, anytime you ask the intern to do something, you make them go look up the answer in the library, right? Mm-hmm. And then show their homework when they come back. That exploded. Like there's, I think, $50 billion in VC money went into it in the first 18 months into those different pieces. So us on getting the raw data to the library, the libraries themselves, which are vector databases, and then the connective tissue between the models and the library to make the intern be able to go back and forth. So there's kind of four key pieces. We're at the very bottom layer. We're at the very 0 to 1. We take all the raw stuff and we deliver it to the vector databases or the libraries. And so hugely, like absolutely critical kind of piece of this model where you've seen trillions of dollars in investment now over the last 3 years all around this core architecture, if that makes
are
sense.
Are people, I can see people really being worried about the security aspect of it. I've got all this proprietary data and it's mine. It yep. has value. I don't know how to use it necessarily to maximize the value, but yet I don't want to just start having ChatGPT work directly with my, you know, my database because, you know, and everybody's going to have access to it potentially. So you want to keep it really in this protected environment. I have to imagine people are like wanting you to show how it's protected.
Oh, this is, you put your finger on sort of the critical thing here, Mark, and this is data security. And so if it's column and row data, say you're an airline company and you have lots of structured data coming in around like off the airplanes, off flight speed and location, sort of it's like sort of security conscious, but it's like, it's not the end of the world. You have emails, you have internal memos, you have strategy documents, you have internal chats. What if that gets leaked? Okay, mm-hmm. That is a huge deal, right? And so what we've seen is this kind of extreme security consciousness, and it's you know, I think it's well placed. So for us and, you know, folks that are our peers kind of in this space that are part of this kind of country, what we've had to develop is the ability to like lift and shift, like pick up the software, go deploy it on isolated servers for these companies, have private hosted versions of OpenAI or Anthropic where they're not going to train off these models and they can't get subpoenaed and see the data. There's been like just an unfathomable amount of work to try and put this kind of behind the scenes in a very secure settings so that they can actually go and figure out how to make this stuff useful. And so that's a big focus for us today, even still.
You mentioned audio and video. So could, and I know that we're probably not the prototypical client because we're like a small business, but you could take video. We post everything on YouTube and we're a podcast. So we have all this raw data, I guess it is, in video form. You mentioned that you can take video and extract it to do things.
Yeah.
Like give me an example. Okay. So you took some guy's pod, say it was Joe Rogan show. He has more money to subscribe to your product. The Joe Rogan show, what could you do for like Joe Rogan?
So you could take, you could imagine what we do is you have like an MP4 file of that, of a recording of that video. You'd send it in, we'd rip the audio, we'd send that to a speech to text machine learning model to get a transcription of it. Okay. Then what we do is every few frames, we'd snapshot the video. We'd send that to an image to text model to get a text description of everything that was going on in that frame. Then we'd fuse that along the transcript. And so now you have the audio transcript. Now you have the scene description transcript. You'd go index all that. And now you could say, oh, what was the body language of that of that guest, right?
Oh, wow.
Oh, how did this person react? Oh, how did they frame it, their take on this particular issue compared to how they framed it when they were on, a news program two months ago or things like that? Give me a summary of everyone who came on and when they came, how much time they got and so on and so forth. You can really start interrogating that data in really interesting ways.
So I'm just sort of like imagining here, so just kind of randomly, that could you ask it which of those, comments or things that happened on his show got the most attention from the audience on social media?
Oh, yeah. And you could take all of that data, fuse it with that as well, with timestamps, and really start generating some unique insights. And so, you have these in the entertainment or in the educational news zone. We're doing a lot with the military, too. Mm-hmm. You can think about how much video data is coming off of some of these platforms that they have overseas today. And then you could think of, like, security cameras or car recordings off of cars, the Teslas or something like that, or just like everything that's going on YouTube each day, right?
Interesting. Okay, so yeah, another example that, say, I'm in the video security business. I own a company that does video security cameras in casinos, right? So you name a casino, chances are they got our camera somewhere. And I'm only imagining, I'm not in the day-to-day, so I can't really speak to even the technology that's out there right now, but I can imagine that somebody who's in charge of surveillance at a casino would really care about, like, it might be body language or activity within the casino that might be deemed, I don't know, suspicious or problematic in some way, to have that be more interactive rather than, what I've seen in the past is just like motion detection and flagging and things like that. But to say, oh, look who just came in the door, Mark.
Yep.
That type of stuff.
You can do all of that. And then you can also use it for things that are relevant to like to sales and to like on the revenue generating side. Like, hey, when are people flowing in? How many people are coming in? Mm-hmm. And where are they coming in as well? And so you could get like, it's really like the interesting thing here is that if you were to rewind the clock, say 6 years, you needed to train lots of little small models to do discrete tasks. So is this a person or is this a shopping cart, right? And that was hard for models for a period of time. It's like, okay, once it's a person, now you need an entirely other model to start doing, subsequent questions here. With the scale of these models today and the performance of these models, you can just ask a lot of them out of the box. And it's really just limited to your prompting, what you're asking mm-hmm. them to do. And then also kind of the analytic engines you have once you create that structured data from this unstructured data.
And is it using, let's say, ChatGPT or Anthropic or one of these large language models, what role does that, do they play? Are they're like the rest of the world, right? So you have all your proprietary data and then you have all the rest of the world. So they sort of act as that go-between where you want to get, let's say, audience review stuff from Facebook or something like that. It can go into, I guess, the rest of the world and bring that back to what you know within your company.
Yeah, so let's go back to this this analogy earlier of the intern, right? Okay. Or this new hire. They're fresh, I went to UC Davis. They're a fresh UC Davis grad. They just got a degree from UC Davis. They have no real world experience, but they got their, they got their bachelor's, right? And they're in their first job. And it's like, okay, well, this is sort of like an out of the box model from OpenAI. It's like, okay, they're pretty smart. They have some horsepower, intellectual horsepower. They don't know jack about casino security mm-hmm. or, warehouse security or something like that, right? And so it's like, okay, well, how do you get them new data or new information so they can upskill, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have two options there. You have one, it's called fine tuning, not to go too far down this, but it's like you send them to weekend courses, right? On the other side, it's like, hey, you know what? I just want you, every time I ask you to do something, just go look up an answer and don't try and make something up on the fly. Look it up and make sure you know. And they get pretty good at that. So the trick is we're doing a lot less of the weekend programs with the models these days. And we're doing a lot more of just saying, hey, just go read these 10,000 pages real quick. And then think about it in conjunction with what you were taught at Davis and come back with an answer. So what that means in practice, Mark, is like, say you have 12 hours of recordings video recordings of, a large group of people, and you're asking it questions. You want it. You want that model to be able to go find relevant new information really quickly. And so that's effectively what's happening is like you use like an OpenAI model, like a GPT-5, which was just launched. Mm-hmm. You park all that data over here and then you make it really, and you build some connective tissue between them. And that is big, big business today. And I mean, this is why Mark Zuckerberg, for example, has been poaching engineers from OpenAI and Anthropic for upwards of $1 billion a year salaries. For each engineer is because that part of it is like part and parcel to what they're working on today.
That's crazy. Okay, so I'm going to stay on the product for maybe one or two more questions, and then we'll jump around because I want to dive into this the employee side of things a little bit too, because you're in that competition as at some level. So what else about the product? Because I'm sitting here going, okay, so trying to find a real world use case beyond what you've said. Does it come back, like when I'm using ChatGPT now, I've got I guess it's the paid version, ChatGPT-5, but it's still, I'm barely tapping the surface of what it can do or what it will be able to do. But it can come back with charts, it can come back with graphics, it can come back and provide summaries or more detail. I mean, it's kind of all over the place. Is that kind of the look and feel of how I would operate using your stuff?
Yeah. Well, with ours, we're deep under the water.
Okay.
And so you would never see us. We're only available via API effectively. And so what we're doing is think of us as like, you know, in the 90s when you said Intel Inside,
mm-hmm.
and you never actually interact with Intel, but everything was powered by Intel chips, by these x86 chips. That's us. And so we are deep in the infrastructure layer. And what we're doing is so like a large company that we're working with, they have Salesforce, right? So they have data going into their Salesforce CRM. They're a Microsoft shop, so they have like Microsoft SharePoint and Word documents and PowerPoints, and they got a range of other applications. What we're doing is behind the scenes, we're vacuuming up all that new data that's being created every day by their thousands of employees, normalizing all of it, and then parking it in that library for them. And so among the different use cases that they're pursuing right now they're averaging around 6 months, 4 to 6 months for different procurement actions. They're a big multinational company for cutting new contracts just to wind its way through mm-hmm. procurement and legal and all of that. They want to get that down to like 1 to 2 weeks through automation. And so they want these AI agents that are drafting contracts, that are reviewing contracts, that are doing most of this legwork that adds to it. That's one of the use cases. Another one is they're saying, we want to develop a new, let's call it premium water beverage offering for Southeast Asia. And they want these models and these agents around these models to go and do market research. They want to build them to build the financial models, literally the Excel models. They want to build first drafts of all the marketing materials. They want this whole package just to come back to them. And then the leaders can just review it, tweak it, give some answers back. And now their time to shipping new products and to moving has gone from months down to days or hours.
Okay, so they're continuing to use their normal tools, whether it be Microsoft or Salesforce
yep.
or whatever. And does the data come back through those systems? What's the interface?
Typically, it's a new UI, new okay. user interface
okay.
that they've paid an Accenture to build, or they have in-house teams. So, I mean, the amount of money that each of these Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies is spending on this is staggering. So most of them that we've interacted with, we're being used today by about 85% of the Fortune 1000. They have 50 to 100 different generative AI teams, separate teams working on separate use cases across the organization. Each one of these teams is maybe 10 to 20 engineers, combination of like Accenture, you know, Deloitte, in-house resources as well. And it's gotten really, really cheap in the last like 12 to 18 months to develop new user interfaces. Like there are these, you know, like Lovable and some of these other new startups have come up where you could spin up an entirely new front end in 15 minutes.
Okay.
And publish it. And so front ends are becoming disposable, all the actions on the back end.
Interesting. Okay. That's really helpful for me to almost digest. Okay, so because you brought up this, let's call it, I don't know if it's an arms race, but there's a, obviously there's a talent, there's a limitation on the really high end talent, right? So Mark Zuckerberg is willing to pay astronomical bonuses and stuff like that for the really high end people.
Yep.
But I have to imagine that the run of the mill coder, programmer, his value is not necessarily going up. In fact, some of these programs, some of these AI agents, they're replacing yep. some of the software developers, but the really high-end ones that know AI, the engineers on AI, they're even in a shorter supply.
You nailed it. I mean, the closest analogy that I can think of is the nuclear arms race in the 40s and the 50s, where you had a few number of physicists who were able to make this stuff work. You didn't need thousands of engineers. You needed a few brilliant folks who really knew how to make this stuff work. That's what's unfolding an hour and a half from where we live here today, down in the Bay Area right now, between Google, Meta, or Alphabet, Meta, OpenAI, Anthropic, and maybe two or three others that are there, which is unreal. Under that, you have exactly what you're saying. Roles for newly minted computer science grads are evaporating mm-hmm. because that's becoming automated through Cursor, through Claude Code, through a lot of this sort of work. And so what that's doing is you have a premium on the super high end, which are making hundreds of millions or billions a year of these researchers, like the top 30 in the world. Then you have this middle layer of director, staff, principal level infrastructure engineers who are in very high demand, folks that we employ to try and make all this stuff work, to fit all this stuff together. Mm-hmm. And then you have the kind of the bottoms falling out is what a lot of folks are worried about right now, is that there are no junior roles anymore. Like they're evaporating. And so,
but intelligence in terms of like smart people are still being created, or people are becoming smart. There's just brilliant people in the world that haven't gotten recognized yet.
Yep.
They don't necessarily have the experience to get recognized, but they still exist in our society. Breaking in to get yourself recognized, is that how you do it through a startup? You sort of like break in, and I helped Brian build Unstructured. Next thing you know, I've got a reputation, and maybe I have even stock options or whatever.
Yep. I think that the game is changing significantly. So the game for like a long time was join a large company, work your way, and then maybe go start a startup. Where what we're seeing now, and you see this if you look at like each of the graduating Y Combinator batches, is folks are often not going to college or they're not going to those big companies. And because you have things like Lovable, because you have things like automated backends, because you have these models available, it actually puts a premium on how well can you market? How well can you ship? What's the user experience when they're using it, right? And so, for example, one of the key employees at OpenAI left by himself, created a company no one had heard of at the time called Perplexity around the time of us. Now I think it's a $20 billion company, and it uses OpenAI models to go search the internet, and is an actual threat to Google. Arvind just did that. He just decided to go do it, and you can just go do that today because there's so much tooling available. And so what it's doing, it's actually pushing a lot of these brilliant folks that are early on, say, you know what, instead of like climbing the corporate ranks, I'm just going to go found a startup. And I have like a vision, I have a wedge, I have capital, right? Mm-hmm. I can go put together a small team and we can go ship, and we can ship very, very quickly.
Okay, so I just have to, I want to get back to the beginning of your career, but I'm really fascinated by this. You're at the heart of what's changing around the world. We've talked about this on the show a few times, so my audience isn't totally unfamiliar. And I mean, you have to be sleep under a rock if you're not like curious about what's going on with AI. But now is a time in my lifetime that I've never seen. I was here when black and white TV went to color, and VCRs and the internet and mobile phones, obviously, like most people nowadays. But the internet was game changing. It feels to me like this is probably more game changing, even though we wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't the internet. It's like, this is going to transform society in a way that it's almost hard to imagine.
Yeah, I think, like, if you want to look at leading indicators here, just to see how big of ripple effect this is coming, like, the first sort of leading indicator is capital, right? The second for us is like data center build outs. But really the one that's most interesting right now is what the Trump administration, as well as like innovative companies, are doing around energy infrastructure and how seriously they're taking a return to nuclear power or small nuclear power plants to just keep up with the energy demands so that we can compete on an international level in AI. And so, I mean, it is, I mean, if you look at like what Elon did, Elon and then Jensen, the CEO of NVIDIA, one of the largest chip, actually the most valuable company in the world, I think right now, they think they just crossed $4 trillion, did last summer. They came in to Tennessee. They had excess power out of an older generation plant. They stood up a new AI-focused data center within 30 days. These usually have a three-year build-out time, and sponged up all of that capacity, and they've already used it all up. This is powering Grok and XAI and all of this. And so if you just look all the way across, if you look at all the indicators from energy to data centers to funding for models, and then to the startups, I mean, I've never seen anything like this. This is incredible, and it's difficult to grasp for historical parallels here.
Yeah, and just for our audience, some of you might be hearing on the news or feeling this even, it's like, okay, white collar jobs are going to tend to go away over the, you know, is it going to happen fast? Is it going to happen slow? I don't have an opinion on that. But what I can tell you, just based upon what Brian just said and what I know to be the case, is that there are not enough electricians, there's not enough welders, there's not enough people in the trades today. And the amount of money that is being invested into just building out the data centers and the grid, the electrical, you know, the power grid, is, I mean, it doesn't take just welders and electricians. There's all kinds of tradespeople that are needed. It's going to be millions of people over the next several years, or over a million, that are going to need to build out just what we think is going to happen now. So if you are like, well, I'm screwed, you might think about like an easy pivot, if you are built that way, to make really, really good money, is you could open up, if you're an entrepreneur, you could be an electrical contractor or a plumbing contractor, or, you know, there are going to be great, great paying jobs, but also great entrepreneurial ideas if you aren't in the cutting edge of, you know, some of these inventions.
Yeah. And you see this happening in Phoenix right now with the huge build out of TSMC, the world's largest semiconductor manufacturer, chose Phoenix for its beachhead. And just the number of construction workers and amount of concrete that's going in down there, I mean, it is the scale of it. This new Stargate data center is the largest building in the world, going in down in Texas to be the largest data center. Just the number of humans that are required to come around this to execute these colossal projects is difficult to wrap your head around.
Yeah. And so, and just to get you thinking this way, this should not be, oh no, it is changing. There's nothing I'm going to do about it. Nothing you're going to do it probably, other than how we control ourselves. So you have to look for the opportunity in these fast changing environments, like what we are. I'd say we're in the first few pitches of the first inning, but the opportunity is going to be enormous if you're, you know, scrappy enough to take advantage of it.
Yeah, yeah, you absolutely nailed it, Mark.
Okay, so I've got a little bit of the gist on what your product does. Maybe we'll back in or start at the beginning a little bit. How did you get into this? I don't know if it's confidential or not, some of the stuff that got you here, but I know you were in the CIA.
Yep.
Obviously, a UC Davis grad, which looks like just a normal life. You end up marrying a Del Oro girl, and then you do all this stuff all over the world. Now you're back to Loomis, almost like bringing it back home again. But it was the story that you told me was pretty amazing on how, on the kinds of things you did before starting Unstructured.
Yeah, it's been charitably a non-linear career path, let's call it that. So I was political science major at UC Davis, had my sights set on going actually into the Navy of all things and being a naval intel officer. I broke my back during college racing motocross around here. So that was out. And I ended up meeting with a CIA recruiter. And they're like, hey, you know, like, you could have a spot here for us. And I was, it never even occurred to me. And I didn't really think about it much. I went back to Davis for a PhD program in political science. I was going to be a professor. And got reconnected with the recruiter. And they're like, hey, come on out. We need you. We're not going to tell you what we need you for. But come on out for a graduate fellowship. So I did a summer out at Langley at CIA headquarters. They put me in the Iraq office at the time. And
Did you have to, when you do that, you had to move to Iraq?
Well, I was at the Iraq office at headquarters at the time. And then shortly after, I went through the training program and dropped out of the PhD program and moved there permanently. I ended up doing two tours in Iraq with CIA, kind of back to back. So I was there 2011, 2012, 2013. Got back from that. Iraq was a bit quiet at that time. And then I got tapped to be the White House briefer for Iraq and ISIS and all that stuff. A week into that job, ISIS took over Mosul and all hell broke loose. And we thought the country was going to collapse. They gave me a desk at the White House. I spent the next year there as a director on the National Security Council for kind of all things ISIS and Iraq related. And so that was like a whirlwind. But around the same time, during that period, my wife and I were getting the itch to move back to California. And so I was like, okay, what am I going to do? You know, this is a really cool path, but I want to chart something different. And so I did an MBA up at Dartmouth. I landed actually an investment making job in San Francisco and spent some time there, and that was great. But I reconnected with some CIA folks who were at a startup at the time, a new startup focused on these language models, kind of like what OpenAI was doing. And they're like, hey, we're hiring like crazy. There were only 20 people at the time. And I was like, I'll sweep the floors. I'll do anything. I don't care. 4 years later, I got a, you know, front seat education to all things AI, machine learning. I ended up running about 85% of the top line for that company. And then through those experiences and running it with the customers, I got kind of an early insights into like, okay, what are going to be the next big problems that are going to be solved as the technology continues to develop? And that was the aha moment to go found Unstructured. And so,
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So let me walk through some of those moments. First, what can you tell me about something that happened while you're in the CIA that people would think was really interesting, that I know everything must be like confidential, maybe not everything. There's a lot of stuff that's confidential, but I don't know if I've ever talked to anybody directly on the show about experience in the CIA. So what would be like a cool story?
Yeah, I am. Well, there's a Starbucks there. No, but I think the rhythm of business is all focused on supporting the president and like the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of State in their decision-making. And so everything is about every morning going in with the best intelligence and the best intelligence analysis to support the president and then, you know, the rest of his staff on how do we navigate China? How do we navigate Russia, Ukraine? How do we grapple with these huge geopolitical challenges that we're dealing with? And so when you're in D.C., everything is focused on that. Like you are just 100% laser focused on serving the president there. Overseas, everything's about collection. And so it's recruiting sources. It's understanding what's going on looking over the horizon for threats to U.S. interests, right? And so it's exactly as advertised overseas. But back home, everything is still tethered to memos that are written in Microsoft Word. And that need to be briefed. And so there's this mundane bureaucratic aspect of it, even though you're dealing with like the most sensitive information in the world. And then there are the car chases and the guns training and all the fun stuff as well. And so it's really varied. You get to work with some incredible people. But like, you know, for example, when I was at headquarters, every morning would be me showing up at 5:36 a.m. and reading for 4 hours straight.
We
built such a giant collection meaning like intercepted phone calls and reports from sources and diplomatic cables, that it was just this enormity of information that would come into like your funnel, into your desk every day. And so I would just sit there and I'd read as fast as I could, as long as I could, to try and figure out what the heck was going on, right? Whereas out in the field, it's more around supporting collection and supporting case officers and so on and so forth.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Was so the decision in terms of you're working for a government agency, so you've got a steady paycheck.
Yeah.
It sounds like at that time you were here, so you weren't, in terms of like being away from your wife, you were married by then, right?
Yep.
Is that right?
So yep.
Being away from your wife, it was like steady and you had something. So the decision to move back here, she's from here, you're from here. I could see the draw for that and controlling your like proximity of where you work, but also the risk associated with like leaving a good job, if you will.
Totally.
Yep. Did you have to go through those emotions? Like, wow, we have a pension or whatever building.
It was tough. I mean, like, you know, everyone I think gets wrapped up like in their, whatever your vocation is, it becomes part of your identity, right? And like, I was really proud of the work that we were doing and what I was doing. You reach a certain point though, where you're like, okay, I'm either going to do this forever or I got to jump. Yeah. Right. And I was turning 30 or right around 30. And I was like, look, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to be a lifer. Right. Which a lot of people decide to do. And that's great. But for us, I was like, if I go further down this road, it's going to be harder and harder to pivot. And so I'm somebody who gets bored quickly. I love challenges. I love learning new stuff. I love like the variety and the dynamism of it. And so I think that the challenge of bolting on a new toolkit and doing something new was really attractive to me. And I think my wife's always helped me make those, like help shove me out of the nest a little bit.
Well, so then you went to investment banking, and then how long were you in investment banking?
About a year and a half.
Okay, enough to get a background in investment banking and decide whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I studied that the whole time when I was doing my MBA, and then I did it for about a year and a half afterwards, and I was just doing mergers and acquisitions with like private equity groups. And I saw it as like additional, like business school. It was a bolt on to business school, right? And so I went from like looking at ISIS terrorists like every day and just thinking about what they're doing to understanding gap accounting and business strategy and marketing and all the stuff I never even thought of before. And so, and then when, you know, going into investment banking, it was really around like, I want to deepen this toolkit, right? And so like, what are you doing there? You're just digging in and trying to understand companies, like how they work, like what are the gears that make them turn. And so it was ended up being unbelievable preparation for me being a founder, right? And starting my own, doing my own
startup. I can only imagine. So then you go spend time in the startup. Basically, sounds like if you're controlling 85% of the P&L, you're on the customer facing side of things and really involved with the human being. So you've got the skill set building there and you understand the organization and the business really well. And so then you moved into a business that sort of has some of the, you were able to sort of tap into probably all of that experience in unstructured, even though unstructured is different.
Yep. Yeah. No, it all built on itself, which is great. I didn't get a lot of opportunity for fundraising. I got a little bit of VC fundraising experience at the first startup. So that was new. But in terms of like the team building and the technology and the strategy part of it, I had a lot of different experiences draw upon to help me with this.
Well, it's interesting. So I started this show by saying I found you by seeing an article in the Business Journal. And with what I do in Sacramento, I get to know almost every startup around Sacramento just because, you know, it's a small pond, I guess. You know, it's kind of like, well, everybody kind of knows everybody. And I didn't know anything about you until I read about you in the Business Journal. And I sort of like kicked myself in the butt. How did I not know about this? But you didn't go around and try to fundraise around Sacramento. Basically, you had an idea at the right time that was good enough where fundraising wasn't this big strain.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it worked out well. So I gave myself 90 days. So I was like, okay, I'm going to like, if I'm either going to take a job or I'm going to get funded in 90 days. So I gave myself an artificial deadline. And first thing I did, I applied to some of the incubator programs like Y Combinator and Techstars and some of the other ones, and ended up getting into Y Combinator. But I also gave myself a challenge. I'm like, every day I treat it like a job. I'm going to have at least like 5 conversations, right? And I'm going to ask those folks to do this. And over time, kind of sharpened the thesis, sharpened the business plan. And then also like VCs talk to each other. They all talked to each other and like word got out. And so, which in a good way. So I had, by about 60 days in, I had about a $500,000 kind of pre-seed round lined up. And I get a text message. I remember my wife and I were at a movie theater. I get a text message. Hey, Brian, this is Enrique Slim from Bain Capital Ventures, like a large VC. Can we chat first thing in the morning? I was like, sure, I'll chat with anybody, right? And we chat. He's like, hey, if you pull back sort of the funding, you freeze the funding thing, we might be able to do something a lot more interesting. And by the next Tuesday or Wednesday, we had a $5 million initial funding round lined up. And wow. I didn't have anyone. I had some folks I had planned to hire, and we had code we planned to write, but it was just a Google Sheet pitch deck. I mean, Google Slide pitch deck at the time.
And that was a little over 3 years ago?
Yeah, that was summer of 22. So we finished the funding on 4th of July, 2022.
Okay, in those early stages, luckily that wasn't your big problem at the beginning. Like a lot of startups say, oh, what's the problem? What, you know, what's the biggest obstacle? Well, I can't get funded.
Yep.
That wasn't your problem, obviously, in the beginning. But then subsequently, you have gone on to raise more money and the company's grown. You now have 70 employees at the moment and you're still growing. Can you walk us through maybe like a little bit chronologically how you got to where you're at today and what would be the status of the company today in terms of like its life cycle?
Sure. So so we raised that initial funding. We were I was really conservative early on. So we only had like 4 or 5 employees for the first 6 months. And then we're coming back to that story earlier about ChatGPT coming out the November after we started. And then that December, everyone like, oh, RAG is a thing and we need to get data to the library, right? And by that January, February, all hell broken loose on demand for our open source solution that we were building. And so we started seeing, like for us at the time, we were tracking GitHub stars. That was like our main metric of success. Mm-hmm. How many downloads? We can see how many downloads it has.
You have a free download. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. I think today we're close to 40 million downloads that it's had. We haven't updated it in 2 years. It's used pretty broadly. And so so at least from an adoption standpoint, VCs track all that stuff. And so they're like, okay, it looks like these folks are breaking out and they're going to be the default for that part of the value chain that we occupy, right? And so by that April, a new VC stepped up. Karan Mahandru from Madrono, which is a big VC out of Seattle, they preempted our A round. So we did a $20 million A round about 10 months after our seed round. And so with that, we took it, we grew the engineering team substantially. And started shipping our first commercial product. And then that December, we've got preempted by another large investor at Menlo Ventures. Tim Tully at Menlo Ventures came in and wrote underwrote like a round that ended up being about $40 million. And so that was the last.
They put a $40 million infusion of capital into the company.
Yeah. And so
what would you consider that? Is that like a Series B? Or
yeah,
what is
we just
that?
We called it a B.
Yeah.
Even though it was like, it's just weird. So one thing, you know, quick side tangent here. Most every startups, it's like, okay, you build it during your seed, right? And then you start, you know, trying to monetize it. You show traction, right? And commercial traction, and there are lots of revenue, you know, annual recurring revenue, monthly recurring revenue, all different metrics there. And then that underwrites it. It was a little different for us and our peers in that it was such an insane land grab during this time around generative AI. Distribution became the huge premium. So they said, give it away for free. Like this was sort of, everyone was doing this. Okay. Vector database companies, other companies like LangChain that are now huge. Everyone was like, let's build great software, give it away for free, and we'll figure out monetization later. You got to become the default early on. Right.
Okay. And so the developer community is just finding out about it. You don't have to advertise. The developer community is just like, hey, they all know what each other does.
Discord, Twitter, Hacker News.
Yeah.
It's all being GitHub. It's all being shared. And we're doing meetups in San Francisco. I mean, it was an unreal time. It still is. But the level of activity. And so it just grew. I didn't have anyone doing marketing. We were just building it. And so we did the $40 million round. That was about 18 months ago when that closed. And then we ended up spending about a year on a big build out on our platform that we now sell. launched that December of last year and have now really been focusing on commercializing that. And so we're, you know, that's sort of the phase that we're okay. in at the moment.
And when you say commercializing, that means taking it to market. You're basically going out and trying to sell it.
We're
sell the
it.
Subscriptions to Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies. That's sort of the sweet spot is that enterprise.
Yeah, I have like 8 or 9 salespeople now
okay.
that are just out there working with customers. We have an SMB seller. We have mid-market sellers. We have enterprise sellers. We have public sector that are doing defense and intelligence mm-hmm. selling to them. Same product, same value proposition, but you know, tailored for different end markets.
Are you finding, so what's the biggest challenge now today? Because I've built some sales forces in the past that had you know a lot of people in them. And obviously that has a level of complexity or difficulty. You've done some of that already in your previous life, but is that a big challenge now? Or is pretty much just, I got to go through and build it out similar to how you've done it before? Or is that, because you're the CEO yeah. of the company now, you got a lot more hats to wear. How does that work?
I think there's a few things, right? I don't know the order of these things, but you brought up security earlier. Figuring out how we deploy this stuff in customers' environments quickly and efficiently and economically, that's really hard. It sounds simple. It sounds like just get your thumb drive and mm-hmm. it's actually unbelievably challenging. So I have a huge amount of my engineering team right now is just focused on how do we collapse that deployment cycle so that the sales cycle is shorter so we can scale faster. It's still a very consultative sale. So we can't just hire great sellers. We need to hire technical sellers who can do a consultative sale. And so we're working on that. Working on our product marketing for these different market segments, different product marketing is going to resonate differently with them and create different funnel. Mm-hmm. And so I've had to build out a whole data strategy team since we're getting millions of data points a day off of open source and our social media and all of this. How do we fuse all this to intelligently allocate sellers' time, who they target, where they spend time, because we're getting so much intent data. Like the data side of this, on the go-to-market side of things, it's an art form in and of itself. And so we've invested huge resources in our data strategy team that we call our RevOps team in order to take the 8, 10, 12 hours a day that we have for each seller and make sure that they're using it as efficiently as possible.
Okay, so in terms of being agnostic, it sounds like your product, where you sit in the stack, if you will, in the tech stack, you don't care what they use. You work with all of it.
Yep.
Okay.
That's exactly right. So any models, any cloud environment, if it's Azure, AWS, Google, it doesn't matter. If it's on-prem, it doesn't matter. That's one thing that is a big selling point for us is that we're deployable almost anywhere. And we're not anchored to any of the big players. Mm-hmm. So you can plug and play with whichever kind of compute or models you want within our stack.
And so you're directly selling to some of these large entities and maybe even medium-sized companies. Are there partnerships that can accelerate the growth so you don't have to hire as many people? You sort of work through some channels?
We're really excited. We just, we haven't even put out the press release yet. I'll say it here. We just finalized an OEM agreement with IBM. So IBM is going to have us as a SKU to get the Gen AI data to their products. Mm. And so that their sales teams are doing it. We're also working to finalize a number of partnerships with very, very, very large, like the world's largest database companies. And so they see opportunity and how do we monetize, how do we activate all of this unstructured mm-hmm. data that's sitting here, like you said, mm-hmm. pain in the butt to use or to do anything with. Like, okay, let's bolt on unstructured behind the scenes. And now folks can start engaging with it in entirely new ways. And so we have 3 or 4 of those deals that we should be announcing in the October timeframe.
When you started it, did you, obviously there's always a vision of something when you start it. And is the vision kind of unfolding like you thought it would? Or is it like, wow, the opportunity is even bigger than I thought it was?
It's growing. I think that we come back to our initial seed pitch deck and we look at it as a company actually quite frequently and some of the core values. And some of the core values haven't changed. Like one of our core values is Toyota is greater than Ferrari. And that folks don't want something that's super fast or that's like got a bunch of bells and whistles. They want something that's not going to break. Mm-hmm. It's economical and it's easy to use. Like we just need to know our, you know where we sit. We're not sexy. We're not the UI on the top. So like build something that's going to be absolutely rock solid. Another thing is like, we have we call it our Ricky Bobby value. Like you're the first or you're last. A lot of the outcomes in our space right now are binary. It's like winner take all for each part of the value chain. And so speed matters, acting with urgency, this matters. But in terms of like the left and right bounds of what we're building, it's gotten a lot bigger, particularly in the last 6 months. And so this is a longer conversation, but for folks that might have heard of this term, but AI agents, agents are really changing the game. And so think of these as like models or a combination of models that you can give over like complex tasks to, and they can autonomously plan it out, execute the task, deliver the results. That's changing some of the architecture here and actually growing our TAM, our total addressable market, dramatically. And so,
interesting. So these AI agents, let's talk about that a little bit, just for somebody who might be like, well, I've heard of it, but what is it? So right now we're thinking of like one agent at a time.
Yep.
And as the world goes to maybe having agents working among themselves, you might be able to have like, how many agents do you imagine working in a cluster with like one human?
Almost an infinite number. Like, there was a TechCrunch article about a company that just got a huge funding round. They have one agent per cell in each Excel file.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we're just all figuring out like how broadly or how narrowly to do this, but like unbelievable complexity in terms of like the proliferation of these agents. Agents are data hungry. Agents don't sleep, right? Agents know exactly what they want. And so we're in this phase right now where we're evolving our tech stack where our user is no longer a human. Our user is an agent that's requesting data. And so this is like, you know, our ideal customer profile, like somebody who's like using it. It's kind of weird now in that it's coming off of being a...
So if there's going to be, let's call it hundreds of millions of agents, I'm just throwing out a number.
Yeah, sure.
As a kind of... naively, how much more capability does your product need to have? Does that mean as fast as these guys start utilizing agents, you need to keep fixing your system to keep up?
Yeah, it is. It's introducing novel new challenges. Here's an unsexy one that's a huge deal. How do you authenticate an agent's request? So an agent requests data from Salesforce or from Gmail. Mm-hmm. Hey, give me all the emails Mark sent about X, Y, or Z. Well, how do you authenticate that that agent should have that data, right? Yeah. That's a big problem that the industry's grappling with right now. And it's hitting first on the agents that Visa and MasterCard are trying to deploy, right? On how do you have agentic authentication that is resistant to like hackers, for lack of a better term. And so there's a whole host of these and like across a number of different categories of new challenges that didn't exist when kind of in this, you know, this older epic of technology that everyone's racing to figure out.
Okay, so in terms of where the money is, where the money will be invested from, you mentioned that you're working with the government and the Defense Department and those kind of people that have, well, they can actually print their money. So there's kind of unlimited there. Obviously, healthcare. I'm trying to think of the different segments of the, I guess, the economic landscape that will be, you know, as you sit there and look at like, okay, where's the biggest opportunities? Where's all my money going to come from? Or where's all this client flow going to come from? How do you think about that?
I mean, for us, the way that we're sort of thinking about it is it's less industry focused right now. It might be, it's more based on all the data analysis that we've done. It's mainly a function of where are they at on their Gen AI adoption journey. We're working with logistics and transportation, biotech, pharma, consumer packaged goods, like you name it, we're working with them. And the best pattern that we can identify is like the folks that are the most tech forward are the ones that are encountering the data challenges the earliest on our side. And so the ones that made those biggest investments early, that have an urgency to compete. Maybe they're in a domain where there's a lot of competition, like fintech. There's like a lot of competition around this. Those are ones that are hitting the earliest for us. But in terms, like, we have, you know, insurance, we have insurance customers, we have others. Almost everybody produces absolutely enormous amounts of unstructured data. So we're still trying to figure that out, Mark. And that creates all sorts of headaches for us in terms of like where we spend time and how we craft marketing messages and where we invest in R&D. But we're trying to just stay fast and flat and kind of deep in the stack right now so that we don't have to necessarily make a bet or two because it's so fragmented.
Well, to continue to drive the growth, I assume that the idea is, hey, let's continue to grow this until we go public, maybe somebody acquires us. You know, we're sort of have an opportunity that's too good to be true for continued growth and to, you know, take this thing even bigger because of that. There's no way it's not going to get a lot bigger. It just has to. How do you imagine that going? Have you thought about that? Because each one of those might take a different, change your life at some level. If you went public, that's going to have one life.
Yep.
If you sold to a strategic or something, that's a different life. So how much of that do you factor? How is it going to affect you? And are you the, you know, are you the one that wants to do those kind of things with your life?
Yep.
Or, you know, hey, you had like three little kids.
Great question, man. I think, look, the path to all of them is almost the same. Like the ingredients to all of them are almost the same. It's like every startup, the goal is, you know, achieve 100 million in revenue and beyond, right? That's like every VC wants to see that. You want to drive towards that. That's sort of the magic number where you can start becoming IPO-able today. However, the last 2, 3, 4 years have been a pretty dormant period for IPOs. Yeah, this rah-rah, but like a lot of them, it's just the market has been valued. So you saw Databricks yesterday announced a $100 billion Series K, I believe.
$100 billion. Wow.
Multi-billion dollar. Series K. Monster funding round. So you have all this private money sloshing around where you don't necessarily have to go to public markets for it. Valuations are good. And it creates a lot of optionality just because like that didn't exist 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do a Series K at a company doing, I think, $500 million in revenue a year, right? And so for us, it's like build a great business, build a sticky product that people love, right? And just keep driving forward and see what happens. I don't know. I don't want to leave Placer County.
I know.
So that's probably the main thing, man.
That's awesome. There are opportunities along the way, though. I have to imagine these kind of discussions have come up, if you don't mind me just kind of getting into this, because I've been invested into companies that got to about Series B and then the founders were able to take some chips off the table. I have to imagine, right, they want to make sure that you are, they meaning the investors, want to make sure that you live, you know, if your company's worth a lot of money, that, you know, you're not, you know, living on startup, you know, salary type stuff. Are those kind of discussions kind of happening with investors and stuff like that? Is that what you guys do?
Sort of. I mean, it's a bit. I mean, we're all just such a competitive bunch that it's like, okay, you did 5 million, you did 10 million, you did 15 million, you know, in ARR. How are we going to double that?
Okay.
How are we going to triple that? And I think that's a great thing about like bringing in the right investors around the table that aren't just going to push you, but like have the operating experience, have the investing experience, you know, can coach you, but also like help you think big too. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at like, there's companies like Cursor, I mentioned earlier, I think they're the fastest company ever to reach $100 million in revenue. It was like in under 12 months or something.
Oh, wow.
It was unreal. And so just the speed with which you can scale if you hit one of these J curves is unreal. And so most of the conversations like with my board, which are awesome, like awesome guys, I'm not just saying that, are around like, we're all just so competitive. We're like, how are we going to go?
That's amazing.
Eat this market.
And it's only, you're only 3 years old, so it's not getting old yet. Like, it's not like, oh, I've been doing this for 15 years and, you know, I've never got a, you know, I'm still making this or whatever. Like, we just started this thing and it's funner than crap.
Oh, I'm working with friends. I like to joke, we don't have any parental supervision. Yeah. And this is one thing, like, just to draw a contract to my government. And I loved my government, my time working in government, but like, Working government, working in investment banking, you spend 3 years in the job in each role, and then you're up for promotion, right? And then you spend 3 years or 2 years or 5 years, right? And then you're up for a promotion and so on and so forth, right? It's no matter how hard you work, that's the formula. Here, it's like on crack. It's like so meritocratic. It's like if you go, you just go out there and you go make a play, right? If you go out there and you go sell like crazy, you build a product that people like absolutely love, this thing could blow up into like a monster overnight. Mm-hmm. And I just love the like how meritocratic it is and like how quick the feedback cycle is in the startup world. It is so addictive. It's like an obsession. And so I'm having so much fun with it. Work with absolutely amazing people that are just killing it, that are not showing up for a job every day. Like they're just believers. And so,
well, I was talking to you a little bit about the growth factory. You know, we invest into startups and I'm kind of a, you know, I went from angel investor to venture capital. I don't have a finance background or anything like that. So we've invested mainly into companies in Sacramento, but, I accused you of being in the perfect position to understand how to invest in startups today. You know the cutting edge stuff. All these, how many millions of downloads are you getting on your system? I mean, you are seeing all kinds of different ways that people are using your stuff at the, let's call it the startup level or the hobbyist level. This, the imagination that gets, you know, is you, the people, the amount of imagination that's collectively using your product right now is off the charts. And for you to sort of see the most imaginative of all of them, and plus having your, I guess, background, you're in the perfect place to be a great investor in startups. Like you have so much, you know, interesting insight into, like, that's already been, I mean, everybody's like, you know, that stuff. I mean, all this stuff is not public, right?
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
All that. Obviously, we all have access to, you know,
yeah,
what's going on out there in the, you know, ChatGPT can go find us a lot of stuff, but you know, like the really cutting edge.
Oh, thanks, Mark. I think, look, there's just so much going on right now that the wonderful thing is like, you don't have to live in downtown San Francisco to do it. And I think that's the cool thing about living up here in the greater Sacramento area is like so many people have come up here during the pandemic, right? And like, mm-hmm. You know, my brother-in-law works for Google and I think we have 3 or 4 people just on our street that are in software in some way, shape or form, but came up here for the lifestyle. Right. And so starting like, launching a startup is easier than it's ever been from this area. Recruiting teams has been easier. Getting access to capital is easier than it's ever been. I think it's a really cool moment for this greater region. And then also just the physical proximity to the Bay Area as well. I'd much rather be here than in like an Austin or in New York or Miami or something like that. So,
all right. This is ask you 2 more questions. Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't bring up? I was just following my own curiosity. So any question I should be asking you now, and then any parting wisdom to our audience?
No, I think we covered a lot. I think the interesting thing here today is just it's oft repeated, but just how quickly things are moving. And so I would, you know, encourage folks who maybe have been intimidated, just go try out Google Gemini and just start experimenting with it. If you're eager, go try Lovable. Go try spinning up an app really quickly, like a, you know, a front end. There's so much that you can do if you just take a little initiative. That wasn't even possible 6 months ago. And so that's like incredibly exciting.
Brian Raymond, unstructured local entrepreneur that's running sort of under the radar unless he gets in the Business Journal or now he's on the Mark Haney Show. So we make you famous in Sacramento.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you.
All right.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you, we're never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.